So the topic of the retreat is clear comprehension, and it's my task today to discuss the first of the four forms of clear comprehension, for the time being we'll call it purpose, clear comprehension of purpose. And it was meaningful for me when the theme of the retreat was announced. One of the retreatants said she was very happy to hear this because many years ago she read a book that talked about mindfulness and it had a section on this clear comprehension. And in reading that section, it kind of changed her practice. It was a very important part of her for her. And she said that the practice went from being two-dimensional to multidimensional. And I can imagine that sometimes is the way that mindfulness is taught, that it seems like all you're ever allowed to do is just be non-reactively present for things as they are. And I think I've been sometimes responsible for this kind of idea and people listening to me too much. And somehow just where, you know, the only thing you could do is no matter what's going on, just be present non-reactively. And there's tremendous power and value in non-reactive presence and mindfulness, but it's not the full picture of what it means to be a full human being. And we have other capacities besides being present and mindful. And in terms of walking the Buddhist path, there's these other capacities we have are brought in together with mindfulness to support the path, to fill it out, to fill ourselves out. And so clear comprehension is one of these aspects that are brought along that support the mindfulness, or mindfulness supports clear comprehension. And clear comprehension is comprehending, understanding the wider context of the situation you're in. That includes a little bit taking into account the past, the future, our experiences of what's going on, might not be taken into account if it's just simply being present for the moment for what's actually happening here and now. So it adds dimensions to practice. And I think of the practice, I've thought of the practice that way sometimes, as adding dimensions to our lives. Certainly adds dimensions to my own life. And the analogy that I've used for my life is that before practice, I was kind of like a person who lived his whole life in a house, never left, curtains were drawn, and I had a TV. But back then, the TVs were smaller than they are now. But you know, 52-inch TV, and I once stayed in someone's house, and they had a TV in the bedroom. So I kind of haven't known what's been on TV since 1972. So I was kind of behind the time. So I surfed, and to my surprise, she had 500 channels. It was like, wow. When I was a kid, there were like seven. And so in my, you know, my earlier life was kind of like I had a lot of channels. And it was infinitely, a tremendous amount of variety and variation and infinitely entertaining. And if one channel wasn't very interesting, just change the channel. And, you know, you could watch something else. And if that wasn't interesting, watch something else. And there were so many channels. I mean, they made so many movies and TV shows and cooking shows and shopping shows that we spent a long time at all the channels. So I was like a person who always lived indoors, always watching TV, convinced that there was infinite amount of stuff to watch. And then someday, some point, electricity went out, and so there was no more TV to watch. So then it occurred to me, well, maybe I should go outside. And then I go outdoors, and lo and behold, there's a three-dimensional world. There isn't just trees on this two-dimensional flat TV, but there's real trees, and you could walk, and you could smell, and you can feel the breeze, and it becomes kind of technical in a whole different way. So in some ways, the practice of mindfulness, of meditation, has added kind of the depth and fullness to my life. That is both fullness and depth to the present moment. There's much more going on here than I had realized before I started practicing. But also to tie my present moment experience into a wider context of life, my life with other people, and to give my life a sense of purpose beyond just being present, but a purpose that connects me with the wider scope of my life, but also the scope of our lives together, the world we live together. So the first clear comprehension is to comprehend, have a clear comprehension of purpose. The word for purpose here is atha. And you've, surprisingly maybe, you've all probably used this word, probably in, maybe in the Sanskrit version, without knowing that you're using it. The name Siddhartha, the artha part is Sanskrit for atha in Pali. So Siddhartha is the name for the Buddha, and it literally means one who has accomplished his purpose, accomplished his goal, accomplished what's beneficial. And the word atha, this word, has multiple meanings, a very important word in India. And it means something like, can mean purpose. It could also mean meaning. It can mean goal. And it can mean benefit, beneficial, what's beneficial. So here, clear comprehension can mean all those things. It's a richer dimension of our life. Clear comprehension of purpose, direction of our life, clear comprehension of the goal, and clear comprehension of what's beneficial. And this last one in particular, I think, is important for Buddhism, because the purpose of Buddhism can be said in a very kind of general terms to be to cultivate, to experience, to attain what is beneficial, what is most beneficial for us. And there's a simple way that the Buddhist tradition tends to talk about this, which I think, because it's so simple, it's maybe overlooked at being how profound and meaningful it is. At least what the ultimate purpose that Buddhism offers itself for is to alleviate suffering, to overcome suffering. And it might not seem like a very grand task, grand purpose. You go back to your high school reunion and you ask each other, you know, what have you been doing all these years? And, you know, and, oh, I became the CEO of some great corporation, and I went, you know, I did this and that. I invented a cure for weak thumbs from clicking the mouse. All kinds of great things to do, right? And then, you know, all you have to say, well, I alleviated suffering. You didn't accomplish anything? The end of suffering? It doesn't seem so great. In fact, when I, many years ago, I went to do a three-month retreat at IMS, at the retreat center back east. And when I arrived, I ran into Joseph Goldstein in the lobby. And I'd met him a couple of years before in Asia. So he, you know, it was nice to see each other. And he asked me, Gil, why are you here? And maybe it was like, see if I should stay or not. The gatekeeper was there. And I said, I'm here to overcome suffering. And so he let me in. But the reason I'm telling you the story is that I then thought about it later in the day and said, oh, you know, that was kind of a puny answer. That, you know, there was nothing grand about that. I mean, I could have said I was going to become awakened or something great, one with the universe, or who knows what some great thing. I felt a little bit like, you know, That was a simplistic answer. I should have had something more profound and meaningful to say. But slowly over the years, I've learned that that was the profound and meaningful thing to say. It was very meaningful, and I've learned that one of the great things is to overcome suffering. Because when we suffer, we're not really exactly ourselves. To really feel at home in ourselves, connected in ourselves, at home in this world, it's hard to do that while we're still suffering. And it's a remarkable thing that it's possible to follow a path that brings the end to suffering, to anxiety, to fear, to greed, to distress, to sorrow. And that, in a sense, it becomes the foundation for how we can then engage in the world. There are, in fact, many wonderful things to do in the world. I would like to propose that we do those a lot better if we've learned how to do them without suffering as we do them. And so I think it's a little bit sad if we justify suffering because we think we have to suffer in order to do all these wonderful things. I'd rather that we take care of the suffering, and then we can do wonderful things. And those wonderful things, what we do, might be very different once we've worked through the suffering, because sometimes what we do is motivated in maybe unskillful ways, unuseful ways, by the suffering we're experiencing. Sometimes the purpose and direction of our life sometimes is compensation for our suffering. Sometimes it's a way of escaping it. Sometimes it's a way of covering it over or putting a Band-Aid over it or something. And it's a whole different thing if we don't have to deal with our suffering. It's not the catalyst for compensation or escaping or covering over. And then our motivations for what we do, our purpose and direction of our life, might look very different when it comes from a place where our heart is at rest, at peace with itself. So the idea of not suffering is kind of what Buddhism offers. There's another way that Buddhism says this, and that this is, I think, for me, been also very meaningful when I read it, that the characteristic of the Dharma, what characterizes the Dharma, is non-harming. The actual word is ahimsa, which many of us know from Gandhi, but it was a word he used for non-violence. The characteristic of the Dharma is non-conflict, non-harming. And to be able to come to a place where we're not in conflict with ourselves and not in active conflict with the world around us. There might be conventional conflict, people might have conflict with us, might be disagreements, but then our heart does not feel in conflict. Our heart is not agitated, our heart is not attacking, our heart is not resisting or hiding, even though our actions might say no or engage someone. There's such sense of inner security, inner well-being, inner freedom that the Dharma has provided us, that there's a sense of no longer being in conflict with how things are. So the sense of purpose, comprehension of purpose. When I was first introduced to Buddhism, my first years of practice was in the Zen tradition of San Francisco Zen Center. And one of the very important aspects of the practice up there was a deep comprehension, consideration, and purification of intention. So we have an intention for practice, for our lives, for all kinds of things. But to really look carefully at what our intention is, what motivates us in what we're going to do. And then to question that, look at it more deeply, refine it, ask further. One of the great questions, you have an intention, ask the question, what purpose is that intention? So that was part of the practice, there was keep looking at the intention. And one of the things I learned, and which I think standard Buddhist psychology, is that intentionality is present almost all the time in our lives. That there's some desire, some wanting that's operating, some sense of purpose operating. And if you just look and you sit quietly in meditation, and you look at some of the things you're thinking about, and chances are, if you kind of look kind of underneath the surface of it or kind of behind it or something, that you'll see that there's a desire that's part of it, some wanting, something that's there that wants to happen, even if wants something to go away or to change, wants something to be a certain way, there's some intention. Even and also so when there's some emotions come up, emotions themselves, sometimes you can look at them and see that somehow connected to the emotion that we're having is some intention. It might not be directly connected, it might be indirectly connected. So for example, you might experience disappointment, but that disappointment arises because there was a hope, an aspiration, a wish, which is kind of like an intention, for something to be different, to have something happen. And that wish, that intention was not fulfilled, and so that disappointment happens. Or if there is a longing you can kind of feel, there's a desire for something, an intention for something, that's part of it. If there's fear, anxiety, you look underneath the surface of it and you might find that there's something we want going on. Maybe it's as simple as we want to be safe. Maybe we haven't had much safety in our lives, and so it's kind of habit, or it's kind of still searching for safety, and that looking and searching for safety is still operating, and so that somehow is connected to the fear that we feel. Anger, same thing. There might be some intention around anger. There's a whole series of things that might be. Pride probably is an intention, a desire for a certain self-concept, self-identity that's operating, that we want to be seen a certain way, we want to see hold ourselves up in a certain way, and that's been challenged, or we want to, you know, or we want to kind of announce it. So it's possible to look at many different areas of our lives in subtle ways that there's intentionality behind it. And if you don't look at that, don't become sensitive and inclusive of that in the practice, then the intentions operate anyway. And that's one of the reasons why some people are surprised at why they do certain things, why they repeat the same mistakes over and over again. They don't understand because sometimes they haven't looked deeply and see what am I trying to do? What's my purpose? What's motivating me to do what I do? If a person doesn't see the intentions they operate under, it's hard to have any freedom. It's hard to have any sense of choice. But if we slow down, like in practice and retreat, there's opportunity to begin looking underneath and seeing what are the intentions, what are the motivations that are operating here. Those can be on the small scale. The intention is to get up in order to go to a walking meditation. The intention is to get up and go to a meal or get tea, go to the bathroom. It can be on a large scale. The intention to be here is to understand something about myself that I haven't so far. The purpose of being on the retreat is to try to alleviate my suffering. The purpose of the retreat is to try to find a richer and more meaningful connection to the present moment or to relieve stress that I experience in my life. So sometimes a large scale, small scale operating, and those can operate kind of simultaneously, overlapping each other. So the practice I had at the Zen Center was to look at that and to reflect on that and understand that and go through the layers of what that was. I didn't do it so much reflectively. Occasionally I did it that way. But it was more a practice of mindfulness, of being attentive to how these choices and intentions and desires were operating in the moment. See them arise, see them being present. And it was a training to begin looking at that, how it operates, how to notice it when it was going on, to include that as part of the picture of the present moment experience. It's easy to do that and get more thoughtful and more confused, maybe, by thinking a lot about it. And this is one of the things that certainly mindfulness practice helped me with slowly, was to not make it complicated, keep it really simple, and just to simply recognize to recognize, oh, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. It also, with mindfulness, helped me with was to learn to recognize my intentions, my desires, my thoughts, and things that are operating, and to be able to see them without a lot of self-consciousness. And that was part of the training that I went through as well, was how to be present for myself and see all the machinations of my mind, heart, and not become self-conscious as a result. It's been said, a little bit as a painful joke, maybe, that self-knowledge is seldom good news. And so, so it's possible with a self-conscious kind of attitude to notice some of the aspects of ourselves which are not necessarily our proudest moments that go on in there, and then use that as fuel for another reason to get depressed, another reason to be self-critical, feel like we're a bad person in some way. And so part of the training that I found in this practice was to learn to see all the funny aspects of my mind, unusual aspects, whatever we want to call it, eccentric aspects of my mind, and not be self-conscious in the sense of using it then to be critical of myself or tie myself up in self-identity issues or judging myself, but learn just to see. Now I'm having these eccentric thoughts, desires, wishes, judgments, aversions, whatever it might be, and just see it in a very simple way. So that was very helpful in terms of intention because, you know, I could have all kinds of some good intentions, some not so good intentions, and then to learn how to see it without criticalness was a training in how to see without being in conflict, without kind of non-harming, right? That the characteristic of the Dharma is to not harm, is not to be in conflict, is ahimsa. And so how do we be present for our experience, whatever it might be, and not be in conflict with it? So a retreat is a great place to experiment with this because outside of retreat, people sometimes can come up with really good justifications of why they need to be in conflict. And sometimes it's hard to convince them otherwise. But on retreat, I don't know if there's not much reason to be in conflict on the retreat. And so we can look at it more carefully. We can look at the ways we are in conflict. We can look at how what's going on within us. And we can use as a reference point the possibility of being present for our experience, whatever it might be, without conflict. Whether it's physical discomfort, a headache, or whether it's some strong emotions that's going on, or whether it's some strange thoughts that we might be having. With a question, kind of the inquiry, what would it be like right now if I'm not in conflict with this experience? And what would it be like right now if I'm not caught in the experience, not feeding it, feeding involvement with it, but what if I'm just present for it? What is that like? And I think it's a very powerful question, this question of what is it like not to be in conflict with the experience? I prefer the expression absence of conflict over the expression acceptance. Some people like the word acceptance, and I practiced that a lot. That was a very, very important word for my practice for years. Radical acceptance of the present moment was kind of a term I had before even the book Radical Acceptance. But I've come to appreciate that rather than using the practice of acceptance, now I like the word the practice of non-conflict, because some things shouldn't be accepted. Because, you know, people are being harmed. But you can, in a certain kind of way, not be in conflict with things. So, for example, if I have a lot of inertia and laziness, I don't know if I'm supposed to just accept my laziness. Or if I have a lot of anger, I'm going to accept my anger. It can suggest the idea, it's okay, I'll just go along. Everyone else better accept it too. Thank you. But rather, non-conflict means I'm not going to be in conflict with my anger, my laziness. I'm not going to make things worse by being in conflict with them. But I'm going to try to be wise about it. I'm going to try to understand what to do about it. Maybe something has to change. Maybe I can find a different relationship to it. But at least I'm not going to be in conflict. And what that means, another way of saying this, is that we don't add suffering on top of suffering. We don't add problems on top of the difficulties we're going through. And we learn how to be present for how it is. So a clear comprehension of purpose can include having a sense of purpose or direction or goal for what we're doing in the practice. And one of them can be to be present for our experience without being in conflict, to be present with our experience with some kind of acceptance, to be present with our experience and to let our experience be our teacher. It helps us show us the way to become free, not to be caught by the experience, to be free and not to be in conflict with the experience. So I know a number of you have shed tears on the retreat, and I would hope that the intention is to have the meditation hall a safe place to cry, the retreat center a safe place, because I know that that's an ordinary thing, and sometimes there's a backlog of emotions that need to be released, and tears is one of those ways that they get released. And I know that from my own tears that I've shed on retreat, that there was all kinds of self-conscious attitudes that came into play around it, that somehow I shouldn't be crying, somehow now people are going to see me and judge me negatively, or I'm disturbing people, or all kinds of thoughts came up that kind of put me in conflict with what I was feeling. And I feel bad about myself. And so the task is to, how do we make crying be our teacher? Meaning, how can I learn from what's happening here so that I can cry without adding layers of suffering on top of it? Just be simple, relaxed. If you're sobbing and the floor is shaking, then you might continue outside in your room or a little bit further away. But if people around you hear you crying, a little bit sniffling, I like to say that it just opens their hearts. If that's the case. So what we do here is we try to make, one of the possibilities in this kind of practice, and one of the possible purposes, is to let reality be your teacher. Let reality be your teacher. And as opposed to other attitudes you can have about reality, because hopefully you're in touch with reality. You know, it was Lily Tomlin who said, reality is the leading cause of insanity for the people in touch with it. So she thought it was overrated. she has a great... But you know, we have all these attitudes about reality, but reality basically means whatever shows up for us here and now. And so, you know, we have sometimes our common strategies, common habits of reactivity to what goes on. Some of them sometimes are healthy and some are not so healthy for us, those reactions. But what would happen if we were able to give priority to the idea that reality is our teacher? And no matter what situation we come into, what is this? What can I learn from this situation? What is it? What can I learn about myself? What can I learn about the path to freedom in this situation here? So, for example, it could be something that shouldn't happen happens. It could be that after this talk, there's time for supper, and it turns out that supper is 3 hours late because whatever. The rice didn't cook. And so one possibility is to be upset, be angry. How could they at this retreat center? It's supposed to be a state-of-the-art retreat center. And, the meal should be on time, and that's the way it should be. And I'm going to write a letter to someone. We'll say, yes, write it to the staff. Let us stare staff, and then we'll put it in the staff shelf, and since there's no staff, it'll never get opened. or something. So you can have some reaction. But what would happen if you come down to supper and supper's late, and And your first response was, oh, what's this teaching me? Not that there's, you know, we're doing it intentionally for you, like there's a, but rather, what can I learn from this situation? What if that's the first response? What can I learn about freedom? What can I learn about the value of not being in conflict with a situation? What can I learn about being equanimous? Or what can I learn about my reactivity? What can I learn about my anger or my fear or my distress or my disappointment? What is it to learn here? And there's something that about that question or that approach, what can I learn from when reality is my teacher, that begins to change the inner ecology? Because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but they say that if you bring a new species into an ecosystem, the whole ecosystem changes accordingly. So if we bring a new species into your mind, guess what changes? And so you want to bring a good species. So if you bring in investigation, interest, curiosity, a sense of purpose, there's a purpose to here. That I bring a sense of purpose. And the purpose is, how can I learn here to be freer? How can I learn here not to suffer because of this situation? That changes the inner ecology. In some sense, a mature part of the mind begins to operate, and you're a little bit less likely to succumb to less mature sides that kind of sometimes, you know, dominate the ecosystem. And sometimes the ecosystem won't change if you sit there and wait, because it's a homeostasis in that ecosystem unless you bring in something else. And so we bring in investigation, we bring in mindfulness, and we bring in the sense of a purpose or a direction, that there's a purpose here. There's a goal that we can have in this practice. And the goal can be to learn about ourselves, to learn the path of freedom here and now, to learn something about how my mind operates when I suffer. What's the clinging? What's the attachment? What are the belief systems that come into play whenever I suffer? And what's the alternative? Is there an alternative? Is there another way? So the idea of purpose, atha, goal, is also connected to the sense of vision, to have a vision of what's possible. And at some point in people's practice, there can be not just an intuition, not just a kind of a vague idea of a possibility, but a kind of a clear sense, intuitive sense, or I don't know, a clear sense of a vision. It's like almost like you kind of see or smell it, you know, close by. Seeing that, yeah, it's possible. On the other side of my clinging, the other side of my suffering, there is freedom, there is peace on the other side. And you have a vision of that possibility of peace. And that possibility of peace then becomes kind of a beacon, a north star that shows us, yes, there's a direction here. I'm going someplace. I'm going towards a sense of peace or a sense of being at home, the heart at home, in, at resting in itself. There's many ways of wording this. And so that becomes the sense of purpose, becomes that to follow that smell, to follow that direction that we're going. So I wanted to offer a variety of words that are, I associate with the word purpose, to see if some of these words might be meaningful for you. So there's certainly the word intention, the intentions of you have. The word purpose, what purpose? An interesting question. For what purpose are you doing what you're doing? For what purpose? I love the word aspiration. What's your aspiration? What's your highest aspiration, or what's your deepest aspiration for your life? I spent years of my life asking myself this question every day. What's my deepest intention? And it was kind of like I would spend time looking at it and looking at it and looking at it, and for many days it would be the same one, and then it would shift and change, or drop down to something, felt deeper or something. but just kind of make that an ongoing reflection. What is my intention? What's my aspiration? I love the word aspiration because it's connected to the word breathing. So respire, respiration, it comes from the same root. So I like it because the aspiration comes from some deep sense of what comes out of you when you're breathing easily, when your breath is easy. What is your aspiration? Another word that I like is dedication. What is your life dedicated to? And I kind of like the word dedication because it's the idea of what's your life dedicated to? Because in my mind, I contrast it with the expression, what do you want in your life? It's a fine question, what do you want? But it has a little different associations, like it can be a pure and beautiful question, but it kind of lends itself to kind of certain kind of self-preoccupied greed. What do I want? But what's my life dedicated to? Perhaps, at least for me, is more kind of heart-opening. It's more like, it's not about me, but it's kind of like, what is it that is going to come out of me into the world? What is my life dedicated to? And so the reflection on purpose from the intention, aspiration, dedication, from the simplest little steps of our life. When I was in Burma practicing there, I discovered that you could be aware of the intention of how you open a door. The intention to open the door. It never occurred to me. I just opened doors. But the idea that you would go, notice there was intention to open a door before you went to open the door. And so they're kind of in the small little details of our life. And then it's possible in the wide scope of our life. What is the important purpose that we want to have for our lives? Since I've opened that, which can be kind of opening Pandora's box, the idea of Pandora, the purpose and overall purpose and intention of our life, there's a lot of suffering around this issue. And I don't want to, now get you all riled up in your concerns around this. I think our society is maybe a little bit neurotically focused on finding the right career or the right purpose, or the right thing, I like to point out that I know enough people who have found their home in the world, not by what they do, but how they do it. So rather than that there's some thing that's their thing, like some particular activity, it's how they engage in their activity, which is they found the primary purpose of their life, dedication of their life. How they are is going to be with generosity, without conflict, with compassion. How they are is more important than the actual activity that they do. So to free some of you maybe from the need to find the thing that your life's going to be about, perhaps, the how is important. So here there's a variety of reflections on purpose that are possible. And so then the question is, how does it support you here on the retreat? And it supports us in a number of ways. One way it supports us is by mobilizing energy. It's a way of overcoming inertia. Sometimes there can occur on retreat certain kind of complacency or inertia or laziness that we don't really apply ourselves very much. I don't remember the story exactly, but one of the great teachers at Spirit Rock is Sylvia Borstein, and she said that she went for years on retreat. Until in practice, kind of went along, just kind of in a kind of easygoing way or something, until she overheard a conversation, I think, between a teacher and someone else. And I forget what she actually heard, the details of it, but the impact of it was that she realized she was just coasting along, and there was time for her to get serious. And so then she kind of applied herself, and then her practice opened up in a whole way. So So purpose and motivation can offer a nice juice and energy and dedication, like be dedicated to the practice in a good way. It can also give direction for our practice. If we don't know what practice is about, it can be very confusing. What am I supposed to do? Why am I doing it? Why am I here? And people sometimes flounder in confusion because they don't have a clear sense of purpose. But with a clear sense of purpose, then it's possible to make choices within the retreat that support that purpose. So if the purpose is to, if the purpose is to have reality be your teacher, then there can be constant choices made to turn towards learning from reality as things come up. And now I have a purpose, and the purpose is to go down and I'll make that long line before the meals, my teacher. See, what can I learn about freedom standing in this line, being present? So it gives a purpose and clarity to what we're doing. Or if the purpose is to overcome suffering, that gives us an orientation to understand that now I need to be attentive to how I suffer. And how I suffer in any kind of situation. So I might be suffering over how I practice. It's possible to suffer in how we try to concentrate on the breath, or how we try to concentrate in practice. But if the purpose is to become free of suffering, then it might be give you some guidance and say, well, maybe I need to step back and notice that I'm suffering and how I try to focus on the breath, or how I try to concentrate. If I'm on a path to freedom from suffering, maybe it doesn't make any sense to suffer in order to become free of suffering. You know, if Buddhism is meant to free us from suffering, I hope you don't suffer because of Buddhism. That doesn't make any sense, right? But you probably will, sooner or later. But if you understand, at least in principle, that the purpose is to be free of suffering, then you have a guide, you have a support, you have a reference point that might help you ferret out the ways in which we get excessively attached or caught, and so we add suffering on top of suffering. If the purpose is, in the medium term, is for one sitting or one retreat or one day, is to focus on getting more concentrated, or focus on being more patient, or focus on being more accepting, then we know that for this day, this is the choice I've made, and this is the purpose, this is the direction, this gives guidance to what I should be doing. And perhaps based on whatever that purpose is, we practice on the retreat in a different way. Clear comprehension of purpose gives guidance to our lives and guidance to our practice. I'll finally say that one of the issues around this sense of whole topic of purpose and goal, direction, meaning, what's beneficial, is that it can lend itself to a lot of discursive thinking, a lot of analyzing and trying to figure out. And there's time and place for that. As I told you, I spent a few years kind of thinking every day about my primary intention. Some of that time was spent going for walks and just kind of thinking and analyzing and discursive thinking about it. And some degree that was productive and useful. But here in the retreat, that's not really generally this purpose of being here in retreat. So you might want to be a little bit careful after hearing a talk like this. You don't need to go into a lot of discursive thoughts now, try to figure out what your purpose is. It might be that you're just looking at the intention that you have is enough, the tensions that arise, simple ones. It might be you have a very simple intention that might support you and guide you here. And it might be that some of the deeper and more significant and larger kind of sense of purpose of what your life is going to be about is not something you're going to figure out, but rather it's something that's going to be revealed to you. Rather, it's something that's going to, as you practice, it's going to emerge. And that's what happened to me. That's as I practiced and practiced, I dedicated myself to practice, And to my surprise, something began welling up inside that gave me a direction for my life. So it was revealed, in a sense, more than something I figured out. And then the last meaning of atta is benefit or beneficial, what's beneficial. And so part of the consideration is always, is this beneficial what I'm doing now? And so if you do a lot of discursive thinking and analyzing, kind of bearing down, trying to figure it all out, you can ask the question, is this beneficial right now? And you might, in this context here, maybe it's not so beneficial. Maybe there's another opportunity here than to spend a lot of time thinking about this kind of topic, but rather to see if the moment-to-moment mindfulness practice can open up something new in this world of intention, purpose for you. And then tomorrow, Andrea is going to talk about clear comprehension of suitability. And suitability is a very important follow-up topic on the sense of purpose, because it adds the practice or the approach of looking at what we're doing and how we're doing it, and say, is it suitable? Is this the right approach right now? This is my purpose, but what I'm trying to do, suitable for that purpose? Or is this purpose I have now, is it suitable for the occasion? So there has to be some suitability, has to be in harmony with the situation, what we're doing. And that's an important part of the consideration, so that'll be tomorrow. It's a wonderful path you're on. It's a wonderful journey that we're on here together for these days. And probably some of you have begun to see that today was different than yesterday. Then tomorrow will be different than today. And may each day be a teacher for you. May reality be a teacher. So let's, there's a custom here sometimes at the end of talks to sit quietly. And part of that is to regather yourself, to settle in. Part of it is to check in with yourself, see how you are after listening to a talk, and let it kind of settle in you a little bit.